Welcome to the Gottesdienst crowd, where we foster confessional integrity, liturgical preservation, and preaching that doesn't stink. We believe that the historic liturgy of the divine service is more than mere cobwebs of antiquity, but it is a true treasure of the church to be dusted off and brought down from her attic to be enjoyed. So let's get dusting. Welcome back to the Gottesdienst crowd. This is Jason Broughton. We have back with us Dave Peterson. Welcome back, Dave.
Thank you.
We are looking at the gospel reading for the fourth Sunday in Lent. It comes from John's Gospel, chapter 6, verses 1 to 15. I'll read that in the English Standard Version. Do you expand this one?
I don't think so.
Okay.
6, 1 to 15, is that what you said?
Yeah.
That's what I do.
Okay.
I don't know if that. I think that agrees with the field with the Lutheran
test?
Missal Project.
Okay. All right.
I'll read that.
I'll read it in the ESV. After this, Jesus went away to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, which is the Sea of Tiberias, and a large crowd was following him because they saw the signs that he was doing on the sick. Jesus went up on the mountain, and there he sat down with his disciples. Now the Passover, the feast of the Jews, was at hand. Lifting up his eyes then and seeing that a large crowd was coming toward him, Jesus said to Philip, "Where are we to buy bread so that these people may eat?" He said this to test him, for he himself knew what he would do. Philip answered him, 200 denarii worth of bread would not be enough for each of them to get a little. One of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, "There is a boy here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish. But what are they for so many?" Jesus said, "Have the people sit down." Now there was much grass in the place, so the men sat down, about 5,000 in number. Jesus then took the loaves, and when he had given thanks, he distributed them to those who were seated. So also the fish, as much as they wanted. And when they had eaten their fill, he told his disciples, "Gather up the leftover fragments that nothing may be lost." So they gathered them up and filled 12 baskets with fragments from the 5 barley loaves left by those who had eaten. When the people saw the sign that he had done, they said, "This is indeed the prophet who has come into the world." Perceiving then that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king, Jesus withdrew again to the mountain by himself. All right, so of course I took a look at Fred Lindemann. And he's just commenting on this day, like why the rejoicing, and then, you know, all the kind of ceremonies that go along with that, particularly the color of the day. And he says, he gives a number of reasons, but I guess the one I kind of like the most is he says, in the gospel reading, it says that the Passover is at hand. This is the place where the people are marked by blood to live, to be enlivened or to be refreshed. And so the church now rejoices because the Passover for us is at hand as well. And we're looking forward to that reality. I thought that was kind of nice.
Yeah, that's really good. I likewise read Parsh, and he's very poetic this week. So he has Easter is coming! Exclamation mark. With childlike joy, the church begins to count the days. Just as on the third Sunday of Advent, we felt the thrill and happiness of Christmas, so now we anticipate the joy of Easter. Herein lies the whole significance of Laetare Sunday. And then he goes into the whole catechism, catechumens again, and so forth. I've been thinking about this since last week, because there was a lot of emphasis on the catechumens there too in the station churches. You brought that up.
Mm-hmm.
Here again, I was reading this, you know, and he was talking about how excited the church is to see these catechumens, you know, coming to baptism or coming to their first communion and so forth. And I thought, well, what about, you know, in our day when we have churches with no, you know, some springs, there's no confirmations, mm-hmm. right? Or, you know, it's one or two kids and so forth. But I think, you know, there's still this idea. Even if our individual congregations shouldn't have any confirmations this spring, there's still this reality that the church is growing.
Yeah.
I mean, I wonder if talking about confirmation when there is no confirmation might actually be more effective.
More effective?
I mean, in terms of the hearers, right? Like, I mean, what if you said, okay, guess what, folks? This would have been Confirmation Sunday, except because you didn't have any babies. We don't have any children to confirm this year, right? And then maybe talk about what's sort of happening, what's not happening that would be happening, and what's happening other places, and to sort of recognize, you know, well, if this is a cross that's been placed upon us, maybe even by our own decisions, you know, this kind of barrenness, we can at least accept it as a, I don't know, I haven't really thought of it, but I there ought to be a certain, right, there ought to be a certain sense in which the barren are able to rejoice in the children of others.
Yeah. Okay.
That's hard. I admittedly, and I mean, I'm not trying to take away the reality of their sorrows. And I'm thinking here about, you know, barrenness that was self-inflicted, of course. But I mean, I think that is something that maybe we do need to teach, mm-hmm. right? That, you know, we get it, you're sad and we're sad for you. And at the same time, right, there are children here that could use and benefit from your love and attention, even if they're not your biological children mm-hmm. or you don't live with them.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the penalty for having no confirmations is that the church has to send $500 to, you know, Concordia University or something.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, maybe I don't have it fully thought out, but anyway, this is another day where, like, Parsh is all about the ceremonies going on at the station churches that are largely related to the catechumens.
Yeah.
And I was just thinking about in our own churches, there was a time when I don't want Palm Sunday to be Confirmation Sunday. I think that's a terrible idea because it's a distraction from Palm Sunday that deserves its own attention. Mm-hmm. But there was a time when it was almost universal, I think, when yeah. Palm Sunday all over the Missouri Synod was confirmation, because of course they didn't have communion on Palm Sunday, and then the children could take their first communion on Maundy Thursday. Mm. Which, you know, that was kind of nice in a way, except you should have communion on Palm Sunday and you shouldn't have confirmation on Palm Sunday. But anyway.
It was really good in a way, but they did it all wrong.
But not so good. That's exactly the right, exactly the apt description. But there was, right, so I mean, there could have been this time when, right? I mean, I have this memory of a child and confirmation being large classes and every Lutheran church having confirmation and I don't know. That's really been destroyed also by, I mean, that's also been destroyed by early communion and earlier confirmations mm-hmm. and no regularity to it.
Yeah.
So we did have something sort of like Parsh describes.
Yeah. I mean, as you have more and more, the regularity almost I don't want to say becomes a necessity, but it begins to be thought about because you're like, okay, we've got this many people and I can't do that many individual instructions.
Right.
Right. So you can see as the church, the ancient church grew and needed more and more instruction, they're just like, okay, we're going to do it this time. And
yep.
kind of happened the same way probably in the Missouri Synod as it grew. And then of course you lose some of, you know, the benefits of that nimbleness when there aren't as many.
Right.
So,
but you also have,
what if you, if you're looking at there's grass in this wilderness, even though we might have a wilderness self-inflicted, and so we don't have confirmation classes, we have this refuge of this grass in the wilderness, which is we still have kids who are coming earlier and are being brought into that reality. Still not, maybe not as much here, but it's still happening everywhere.
Yeah. And I think in some ways, actually, confirmation instruction is superior to what it used to be. The old people don't like it when I say this, but look, the emphasis upon the actual text of the catechism itself and the, you know, I mean, so if there's any old people listening to this, I mean, here's the way it usually goes. They will see the children at our church communing, mm-hmm. and they will say things like, "Oh boy, you know, in our day, confirmation was really a big deal. And man, we went to confirmation instruction for a long time and we learned a lot and it was really rigorous and really thorough. And then I just say, oh yeah, what is the office of the keys? And they can't answer it. Yeah. They can't, I mean, they might be able to say, well, it's confession, absolution, or they might say, you know, it's the power that God gives through the church to pastors to forgive sins or something. They can't recite the catechism.
Yeah.
They cannot recite the catechism. They might be able to recite the Ten Commandments. They might be able to recite some of the meanings. And so I just will then say to them, well, as good as your instruction was, for some reason it didn't stick.
Yeah.
And, you know, we just got to call this out. We are currently, for the last 20 years, the emphasis in our circles has been upon the text itself and recitation of the catechism. And, you know, I've only been doing this for a few years, but we require our elders to be able to recite the entire catechism, just like an old time eighth grader. Mm-hmm. And why in the world would the elders not be able to do that when we require it of children before they can take communion?
Yeah.
And, you know, now I've got my whole council does it. We're really working. But the point is that we're just seeing the value of actually reciting the actual catechism. Mm-hmm. And I think some of it is along with this kind of push or this emphasis that's come to us from classical education as opposed to progressive education.
Yeah.
Writ broadly, progressive education is what probably every single person hearing this, that's how we were educated.
Yeah.
And the theory ultimately was, and still is in standard Lutheran schools and in all the public schools, the idea is that people need to understand things before it's of any benefit to them. Mm-hmm. So they spend a lot of time explaining how multiplication works before they make them memorize the times tables.
Yeah.
And then they want them, right? So if they understand it, then the memorization will make sense. That's the theory. Well, the church never operated that way until then. It was always, we taught people, and for the most part, we still do. We teach children the Apostles' Creed and the Lord's Prayer before they know what the words mean.
Yeah.
And then they spend their lives learning what those words mean. And so we got in confirmation. If you look at the confirmation material published by the CPH, probably still, really, I haven't looked at it in a long time, anything that's been published in the last 10 years. So maybe I'm wrong on this, but the confirmation instruction was completely progressive in the sense of its philosophy of how education ought to work. Mm. Huge emphasis upon, you know, kind of what does this mean and how do we understand this and apply this?
Yeah.
And
but that makes sense in the time that they were being taught it, right?
I mean, if they're being
taught in like seventh and eighth grade, that's the time to do that.
Yeah, that's true too.
So
but, I still want to see the emphasis, but I still want to see the emphasis on the recitation.
Yeah.
Even in adult confirmants.
No, yeah.
Because when you memorize something, when you actually know, if you just know what it means, okay, good. You know, the problem is going to be is that if you end up in a Soviet death camp and all you have is what it means and not the actual text, you don't actually have that much. And you also, if all you have is what it means and you don't have the text, it gets stripped away from you very quickly.
Yeah.
Whereas if you know the words themselves, you know, which most of that is actually the inspired word of Holy Scripture. If you actually know the words themselves, that is deep and that doesn't go away. And that changes you from the inside out.
Yeah.
And then you see, because it's a part of you, not just something you know, but it's a part of you deeply, precisely in the actual words. Then what happens is those words become defining of reality and the way that you see the world rather than the meaning. So I didn't plan on getting into a big speech about memorizing, but I did anyway.
Yeah. Well, that's where things like the Congregation at Prayer that has a bit from the catechism to focus on each week is really, really helpful.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think it's at this point, I would say, like having something like that, a Congregation at Prayer handout that the whole congregation is given every week that guides their daily devotions, that includes recitation of the catechism and includes prayer, the prayers of the church. I think that's like a key tool for ministry, like right up there with an automobile. I mean, I don't know how you'd be a pastor in the Missouri Synod if you can't go visit people, right? It's I mean, it's nothing in the Bible about having a car, but it seems like in America you need a car. And it seems to me like I couldn't be a I couldn't be a parish pastor without the congregation of prayer. That tool is required.
Yeah. So last week we were talking about the organic development of the liturgy and rite and ceremony. Do you think that there should be, maybe this isn't organic, but do you think in our day, we should spend some time maybe before the sermon or after one of the readings of doing a recitation of the part of the catechism? I know that you're probably that's not very Gaudeamus.
Yeah, I know. It's not very Gaudeamus. We do that at Matins. Mm. You know, Matins includes recitation of the catechism and of a Bible passage. Our whole congregation, you know, gets a piece of the catechism and a Bible passage every week to be memorizing together. And we do it at Matins. But in the divine service, that would feel artificial to me. I would be resistant of that, even though I see the benefit of it. It would just feel like such an interruption of the flow. I guess maybe we could think about it. I haven't really thought about this, but I wonder if it wouldn't be worthwhile doing before or after the service.
I get that.
I don't know. You don't do that.
We don't
do
it. No.
Do you do it? I mean, maybe it's worth thinking about, and maybe I need to change my mind on it, you know?
I mean, I'm just wondering, like, maybe you just had it as an intro to the sermon. Like,
yeah,
okay.
No, I get it. Yeah.
Let's pull out your congregation of prayer. It's right there, right? If it's the bulletin.
Yeah. We do it as the opening for Bible class, but you know, that's not. So yeah, maybe I should just do it at the beginning of the prayer, at the beginning of the, it just feels a little flaky to me.
I don't know.
I don't know either. I mean, I certainly see the obviously the kind of catechetical benefit of it and focus, but it just feels like pulling them out of the rhythm of worship and the, you know, being in the presence of God into being in kind of a classroom in a way that, even though, I mean, I'm all about didactic preaching, I don't know. I have to think about that some more.
Well, maybe it's just something that you try to be cognizant of including in the sermon, like making reference to that particular part of the catechism or that particular Bible verse that you're memorizing.
Yeah.
But that would take, that's not a ton of extra work, but it is work.
It is.
That wouldn't
anyway, the whole awareness of the catechumenate, I think we could, there's an awareness of the catechumenate in Parsh and Fred Lindemann sometimes at least, that maybe we could cultivate, even if it's different than, you know, going to the station church in Jerusalem and being scrutinized or whatever.
Yeah.
Not Jerusalem, Rome. It's always Rome, right?
So if you had to like label the theme of the day, besides rejoicing, what would you call it?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, rejoicing is certainly.
But you're the rejoicing
theme. I think
over
there's
what?
Also, yeah, you're rejoicing that Jesus provides life that is greater than, or how do we say this? Life that exceeds or surpasses death. So I think we've been through this text on this program quite a couple times at least. You know, they come. The multitudes are following sort of blindly or selfishly, right? They're seeking relief from illness. They're coming because he does miracles that relieve illness. So it's really, they're coming seeking a relief from death, but they don't know what that is. They're only looking for temporary relief. They're not looking for salvation. And of course, that becomes illustrated even after the miracle because they try to seize him by force and make him the bread king. And I think there's this beautiful moment where it says Jesus lifts up his eyes and he sees them coming. And, you know, they're walking up the mountain, probably looking down at the ground because, you know, when they have to.
Yeah.
They're climbing. So it's probably not that steep of an incline, but they're looking down and they're trying to escape death, but they don't know how to escape death. And I think it's kind of like, they go into this grassy place. Well, that is, they're going into a pasture for cattle that will be slaughtered, you know, but they have no awareness of it. They don't realize how, and of course, in the other account, you know, in Luke or Mark, I can't remember, right? Jesus has led them out deliberately into this place where there is no food. And they've been distracted by his teaching and his presence and perhaps his miracles so that they have forgotten that they are hungry. And it comes upon them as a surprise when it's too late for them to do anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
So there is this, that Jesus uses this to expose their weakness, their mortality, and then, of course, provides for them. So
has there ever been anyone that has linked the statements of our Lord to Satan in Lent 1 during his temptation to all the things that happen in the rest of Lent? Like, this seems like you don't live by bread alone. You get bread.
Yeah, it does.
But it's so, how would you make that? I mean, what would be Lent 3 and what would be Lent 2? The casting out of demons.
Let's see. Well, casting out demons could be the not worshiping Satan.
Mm-hmm.
So let's see. What's the other one? The service of angels.
Yeah.
Where is there a, I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not sure either.
It feels like to me.
You definitely get the application in what, Lent 5, that these people are speaking for Satan. You're a liar. You're like your father, the devil.
Right.
Or you're deceiving people. This Lent 4, you get the bread. Lent 2, the Canaanite woman.
Well, she's daughter's possessed by a demon.
So she gets help.
Casting out a demon.
Yeah.
I mean, casting out a demon seems like sort of the opposite of worshiping a demon. I feel like every Sunday it's the man shall not live by bread alone.
Mm.
Seems like that's the one that speaks to me the most constantly. I mean, the angel one, right? Go to the highest pinnacle of the temple and throw yourself down. So that maybe I don't know how to apply it. I don't feel like myself. I don't feel like I'm tempted in that way. But if I'm hungry.
I mean, we are tempted to.
Yeah. What's the correspondence?
In that particular application, it seems like it would be to go beyond what God says. So not just trusting in what God says, but to, all right, we're going to put him to the test. We're going to do something.
Yeah, tempting him.
To tempt God. So we're going to be reckless, not just courageous.
I don't know. I guess it's hard for me to think of how, I don't think I'm reckless. Maybe I am and I'm unaware of it.
Mm.
Well, I suppose every time we sin and presume upon God's grace,
yes.
I mean, that's reckless. I do that plenty. that is reckless. I mean, that is, but it seems seems different than trying to get God to send an angel to catch me. But maybe that is the correspondence, that we expect that we can sin with impunity and we expect God to forgive us and we as though, yeah, you know what? I think that is it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is it because, you know, the promise isn't throw yourself off a temple and the angels will catch you. And the promise is your sins will be forgiven. The promise isn't sin all you want,
right?
And just just take advantage of this and take right. That's a presumption upon grace that's inappropriate, right?
Yeah.
So maybe that is the application: deliberate sins or sins against the conscience, planned sins. Yeah.
Okay. So
we should have done that. We should have talked about that on Invocavit instead of now. But
yeah. Well, but I mean, it does kind of.
I know.
Get us thinking about how are these things playing in? And you can kind of rehearse all of Lent
in
a sermon, right? You can go back and say,
sure,
this is where we began. Okay. So in terms of like context, the actual text, is there anything within the context of John's gospel that this is, that helps us understand? I mean, the feast of Passover is at hand.
Yeah, I mean, well, I don't know if it's exactly. I mean, chapter 5, he heals a paralytic on the Sabbath, and they get mad. So that's the sort of setup or the context of it. And he's withdrawing to some degree from their hostility. I mean, I think within John's gospel, I mean, this is this is part of this great Eucharistic discourse in John, which is not given in the context of the Last Supper mm-hmm. or the last Passover, but is given instead here, right? Of course, all the preachers know, John doesn't record the words of institution.
Yeah.
The children always struggle at the catechism because they go, the holy evangelists, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Yeah. And they would say, no, St. Paul, because John doesn't have it, but Paul does in 1 Corinthians 11. So, I mean, in terms of John's purpose and understanding, I mean, he is absolutely 100% in my mind, he is teaching about the sacrament of the altar as the antidote to death and this kind of blind. Mm-hmm. And I think he's also foreshadowing the abuse of the sacrament with the desire when they try to seize him and make him the bread king.
Mm.
So, you know, by that, I mean the abuse of the sacrament in Rome with the kind of those kinds of abuses the Corpus Christi processions, the palming of the body of Christ to put it on the grave of your relatives, you know, that stuff,
mm-hmm.
instead of eating and drinking it for the forgiveness of sins. So, you know, it's great that this Sunday that you have the most explicit allegory in all of Scripture in Galatians 4, and kind of like one of the hardest ones, right? Sarah and Haggai. And then you have this reading that, again, I think needs to be taken allegorically to some degree. So one of the complaints always is, well, when Jesus feeds the 5,000, he hasn't instituted the Lord's Supper yet.
Right.
Yeah. Big deal to me. So what, right? When he institutes the Passover, he hasn't instituted the Lord's Supper either. I mean, does the Passover teach us about the Lord's Supper? Absolutely. Does he have in mind the Lord's Supper when he institutes the Passover? Absolutely.
Yeah.
And, you know, he is foreshadowing and teaching about what will come later. And of course you have this, that later they understand these things.
Yeah.
And so the things that they're being taught now, they don't understand. We have that experience in our own lives, in our just kind of mundane lives as well. You know, oh, I remember my dad saying this. I never knew what it meant. Now I do.
Yeah.
I never understood. I can remember being just flummoxed as a child, a teenager even, because my mother used to say a lot, you can't have your cake and eat it too. And I always thought, what in the world's the point of having a cake if you don't eat it?
Right.
Right. So it didn't make any sense to me. And then I was like, oh, once I eat it, I don't have it. Okay. Yeah. But, you know, so, I mean, sometimes it takes, you know, years before these things actually, you go, oh, I know why she said this now. And that's what's happening. He is teaching about the Lord's Supper, and he is teaching, he's also showing himself the new Moses who fulfills who's providing manna in the wilderness, you know, at the time of the Passover, and he's fulfilling the Passover.
Right.
And they're mad at him. I mean, they're already mad at him about healing on the Sabbath. What do you think they're going to think of this?
Yeah. You know? I mean, I really think, primarily in John, it's to show that he's a fulfillment of the Passover, but that obviously has implications for the Lord's Supper, right? That they're not
completely
distinct.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, because the Passover hasn't been all the way fulfilled until he dies and rises.
Right.
But giving manna in the wilderness is a pretty ballsy move.
Yeah.
I mean, who does he think he is?
Right.
Right. I mean, you know, I mean, if you know, he healed on the Sabbath, I mean, if that's offensive and that violates their custom and threatens the authority of Moses as they understand it, look at this.
Mm-hmm.
And then of course, it goes to like 11 in your terminology on Maundy Thursday, because mm-hmm. he doesn't just give them manna. He gives them blood to drink
right.
that's explicitly forbidden. I mean, mm-hmm. the absolutely unimaginable, I think, before he does it. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's this great little thing, you know. So in John, he says, you know, unless you eat the flesh, that is, the sarx. The sarx in the Old Testament, obviously, the sarx in the Old Testament is the flesh, but it has the blood in it. And the word for the sacrificial flesh that didn't have the blood in it is a different word. It's crea or crayon, not like crayon that you scribble with, but Kappa Rho Epsilon Alpha. And yeah, so it's a different word. And you said ballsy. It's ballsy. He's saying you've got to eat the living flesh, the stuff with the life on it.
Right. I mean, that's the reason. I love this too. You know, the reason it's forbidden, blood is forbidden in Moses is because the life is in it. Mm-hmm. And then the reason he gives it to us to drink on Maundy Thursday is because the life is in it.
Yeah.
It's the same reason. Yeah. So, of course, we have the other sayings, you know, in John 6 about the bread. And Moses named explicitly in verse 32, truly, truly, I say to you, Moses did not give you the bread from heaven, but my Father gives you the true bread from heaven. And guess what? It's me, mm-hmm. right? For the bread of God is he who comes down from heaven and gives life to the world. I am the bread of life. He who comes to me shall never hunger, right? All that stuff. I mean, it just goes on and on. I am, and then he says, finally in 41, look, you fools, I am the bread which came down from heaven. Mm-hmm. It's beautiful and we love it. And when we say, it's not that he's taking a risk because of course it's all true, but from their point of view and their resistance to this, it's outrageous.
Yeah. He's just extra. It's like, he just doesn't stop. He doesn't know when to call it quits.
Yeah. I just always think it just seems like they've always just got to be like, oh, who in the world does he think he is?
Right.
You know? And of course, he thinks he's God. That's who he thinks he is. He's equal. And that's what got him in trouble, that he made himself equal to the Father in chapter mm-hmm. 5. So again, you know, this is really all of that's good. Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful. I think it's the second most popular miracle in the patristic literature. Mm. The most popular miracle, the one that they comment on. I mean, I've never really like tried to measure this, but it seems to me that the early church, the writings that we have, their favorite miracle is the wedding at Cana. They mm-hmm. just talk about it all the time. And number two is this.
Yeah. Is there a sense—
And of course, both of them—
That you brought up in chapter 5, the healing on the Sabbath, and all the discussion that, you know, the Sabbath was made for man and not man for the Sabbath. I don't remember if that's it, particularly in John, but that even on the Sabbath, the Father's working, that you see here— They're in the wilderness. They have to go up. He's already there. They sit down and rest, but he's still working. So it's like he's demonstrating that even though you're at rest, God is still at work.
Yeah, God controls. The sun still rises mm-hmm. at God's command on the Sabbath. His rest is not like our rest. Yeah.
He won't rest until he's placed into the tomb.
That's right. That's right. There's no place for him to lay his head, even in this grassy place, mm-hmm. right? Which, by the way, is probably the place where the foxes live.
What?
So, yeah. Even foxes have holes. Birds have nests, but there's no place for the Son of Man to lay down his head. And here he's in fox territory right now.
Okay.
And he doesn't rest. So, right?
Okay.
Well, anyway.
Any translation problems that you caught?
I didn't like, what was it now? I put away my Greek. Oh, I don't like this. You didn't have truly for alethos at the end of that somewhere. The Greek has, truly this is, what verses? I've been turning the pages of my Bible.
Oh, so they verse say, 14, this is indeed this the is prophet who is to come into the world.
Yeah, that's annoying. Truly, verily, but anyway, was there something else? It seems like there was something else picky like that. But I mean, indeed, I don't know. It just doesn't ring right to me. Mm-hmm.
Can we say, you know, actually,
there's the fish thing. Oh, I noticed.
Actually,
I also,
actually,
this is actually, this is the prophet. That would ruin it, wouldn't it? I noticed when I was looking at this morning that, you have that, Iota Omicron Noon ending for little fish, like we had last week with the little dog.
Hmm.
And you had both. You had it in the, you have it without it. And then, so that diminutive came up again.
Hmm.
And,
Hapsarion.
I didn't have to look it up that it was a diminutive because last week. So that was kind of like, oh, look, there it is. That is how you make a diminutive in Greek.
Mm-hmm.
No, I didn't have any other translation stuff.
Okay. So what about the barley? Anything with that?
I don't know.
Is this indicating like it's not actually the Passover because it's barley, but you're going to get it when he talks about it later? His flesh is meat and he is the manna.
I don't know. I wish it wasn't barley in my fallen ideal of what I think would be more theologically interesting. Mm-hmm. Just because it's one of these, because it gets us into this whole dispute about what is bread for the Holy Communion. Mm. And then you got the barley thing. So I don't know anything about that really. I've never, there is something about also, I'm just going by memory. It has to do with, right, when it could be offered, but then also, is it like for poor people or something?
Yeah. Yeah. So
it's rougher bread or.
Yeah. So I get, what the first gleaning or the first harvest of the wheat is that first week of Passover, isn't it? So it's the end where you offer up the first fruit. So that hasn't been offered yet. So maybe they're out and they've already had the barley harvest at this point, because that happens before the wheat harvest. I'm pretty sure I remember that correctly from the Old Testament. I'd have to look at to figure out the actual reference there.
Right. I don't know either. And it seems like I've heard that these are some kind of, that this is a smoked fish. Mm. Preserved in some fashion, maybe not smoked,
okay.
And so seems like I've read stuff or heard people say that, this is the kind of food for pilgrims is what I remember. Mm. Traveling food.
Mm. So barley, perhaps barley doesn't decay or rot as quickly. I don't know.
Maybe. I don't know. It's like hardtack or something. Yeah. I don't know if that's true. Preachers say stuff and, who knows where they're getting it. And
right, I know.
If those sources are accurate. But I've heard that idea before. It could, I'm not denying it. I just don't know.
Okay.
It seems like it kind of fits, if they're there, if these people have come from a distance for the Passover, they've brought traveling food.
Yeah.
This boy, why is he carrying food around, So food you carry around kind of by definition is traveling food.
Mm-hmm. Is there an application here about the Lord taking up even the smallest amount from the smallest one and putting it to the use for the greater people? He's really elevating this young boy.
He is. It's like the widow's mite. If this boy gives this to them, he doesn't have anything left to eat. Mm-hmm. There's a big risk. I have down for under the fivefold use for training that something is better than nothing. Mm. And I think one of the places that we get squished, by demonic influence is this idea that, right, it's got to be big. We're trying to raise, we're trying to build it. We're not here, but we're trying to build an education wing and we need $5 million, and you come up with your gift of $100. Well, it would take us, I don't know how many tens of thousands of gifts of $100 to get to this $5 million mark, right? Yeah. So there's a kind of temptation to go, that's not a significant of enough gift to matter. And, that's maybe true in a kind of fundraising sense in some way, but theologically and spiritually, right, we're God multiplies these things and we should expect that. And we shouldn't keep our efforts just because they're imperfect or because they're small, but we should expect them to be blessed.
Yeah. Well, that phrase, something's better than nothing, is also used kind of in a way to allow for really kind of lax understanding of things. Well, something's better than nothing.
Oh, really? I've never heard.
They're like, well, they grew up Lutheran, but now they're going to a non-denominational.
Oh, like, yeah.
Something's better than nothing. Or, they're just watching at home. Well, something's better than nothing.
Yeah, I could hear that. Yeah. Well, that's not the way I've usually heard it. I can hear it when you say that for sure. But I've usually heard it as, look, you're thinking the only way I'm going to get any benefit from exercise is if I run a marathon.
Right.
And it's like, look, no, just, you know what? Just walk around the block.
Yeah.
You know, there's something's better than nothing, you know, that do something. And even as small as it is, I mean, I do think we could, well, maybe this is a phrase to be redeemed then.
Yeah.
You know, that's always kind of fun. So we're not saying here when we say something's better than nothing that we're settling, mm-hmm. but we're rather saying we're stepping in faith and believing that God will bless our efforts, even though they might seem to the world not that significant.
Yeah, it's the difference between settling and recognizing that you don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Or, yeah.
And I think this boy is an example of it. Yeah, or you know, it's the same thing. We make the mistake psychologically on the other side too. You know, I'm going to fast. And then, you know, I see Oreos and then I eat one. And, well, the fast is ruined. I might as well eat the whole bag.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. I took one wrong turn. I may as well get lost.
Right. But that we do that to ourselves.
Oh, yeah.
We sabotage ourselves. So, I mean, you know, there's this kind of, I don't know, there's some practical advice to be had there. And I think, you know, really seriously, theologically, that we absolutely should and must have this expectation that God does bless our efforts. You know, I'm going to give a dollar to the church and I'm going to trust that God will use that to spread the gospel. Mm-hmm. Right. And, you know, I'm going to tell my neighbor about Jesus.
Yeah.
And it may seem like nothing happens, but I trust God to use that.
Mm-hmm. So what other training in righteousness do you have for the fivefold use?
That's the only one I had under training. For consolation, I've got that he lifts up his eyes. And I was thinking about, you know, I hate this in a way because it's so awful and it's so schmaltzy, but the sort of sentiment behind the footprints poem, right? Don't use the footprints poem. Whatever you do, do not ever use the footprints poem in a sermon mm-hmm. or anywhere. But because it's just so schmaltzy and so overdone. That being said, I mean, obviously the sentiment in it is legitimate, that God is caring for us, particularly in the times when it seems like he isn't, right, in our lives.
Yeah.
And here I think, you know, I think of those people walking up this mountain with their eyes cast down, just thinking, you know, I hope I can get healed from bursitis, you know, and they don't realize that they're walking into a death trap, that they're on the verge of starving to death mm-hmm. and that, you know, death is seeking them and has a good track record of winning. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, despite their kind of just, you know, plodding along and seeking so little from what God actually offers, Jesus lifts up his eyes. I mean, he's watching them. And he's guiding every step. And he is actually, right, there is no danger for the Christian.
Yeah.
You know, I talk about this frequently, but we try to train our acolytes and our field workers to not panic when things go wrong in the liturgy.
Right.
You know, to not draw attention to it and make a big deal, because what stuff goes wrong, you know, we're in the presence of God. He is gracious. We don't want to be irreverent and, you know, inattentive, but we also aren't going to panic if, like, some of the blood is spilled, for example. Mm-hmm. If, you know, it was spilled on accident when we were trying to get it to the people of God. We'd rather it didn't happen, and maybe we need to ask a few questions about how it did happen, but, you know, we're not going to act like this is, you know, the most horrible thing that ever happened in the world. So the example I use to them now, I say to them, look, if the church catches on fire during the worship service, I expect us to form up in a procession and calmly walk out,
mm-hmm.
you know, because, and I mean, thank God that hasn't happened so far, but, you know, the idea is that we want to be reminded ourselves and help the people that are there whose worship we're leading to remember that we're in the presence of God,
mm-hmm.
and he is gracious and he is kind and he loves us, and we're not going to panic. There's no, in that sense, there's no such thing as an emergency. Because,
mm-hmm.
I mean, what could possibly happen? The building's on fire and the timber falls down and I die and go to heaven? Great.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or I get maimed and I live the rest of my life in pain? Great. I mean, because all things work together for good to those who love God.
Mm-hmm.
And so that kind of sense of God is actually watching, controlling, caring is more aware and conscious of the details mm-hmm. and the needs of your life than even you are.
Yeah. And what did you expect? Right on top of the, you know, the great, he's told us this is the way is difficult and the door is narrow.
Yeah.
Okay.
I also had under consoling, I really love this. And this is like the most Eucharistic passage of the whole thing, right? And Jesus, verse 11, Jesus took the loaves and when he had given thanks, he distributed them to the disciples and the disciples to those sitting down and likewise of the fish as much as they wanted. Mm-hmm. So you've got that kind of fourfold action, right? That he takes, gives thanks, gives it, and they eat. And then, but I love this. This as much as they wanted,
It's extravagant.
It's extravagant. And of course, then you have that whole thing with the baskets being filled. So it's like the water into wine at Cana in its abundance and its extravagance, but also, and its generosity, but to think of that as having a Eucharistic application that, I mean, it's literally that they just eat till they're full, right? Physically, they're mm-hmm. satiated. But to think of how in the sacrament of the altar, God gives us as much as we want. Mm-hmm. He's not holding back on us, right? He doesn't just forgive some of our sins. Right. There's this bestowal. I mean, if you really think about what he does in the sacrament, I mean, it's profound.
That is there we a eat sense his risen that- body. Some people are holding back, not taking as much as they want.
Well, that's what I was going to say. I think we do that sometimes. We don't. I don't know if we want forgiveness of all of our sins because some of our sins we're quite fond of. Mm. You know, are we holding on to our sins? You can forgive these, but don't mess with this part of my life. And I think maybe we need to learn to want everything that he gives.
Mm. Yeah.
And, you know, what about these people that don't take advantage of private confession and absolution? Mm-hmm. How is it that Jesus institutes something and you're like, I can take it or leave it. I've just chosen to always, always leave it. I mean, can you imagine somebody like a Missouri Synod pastor saying, yeah, I teach the small catechism. I know about the sacrament of the altar. I've never actually had it myself. But, you know, for people that are weak in their faith or whatever, you know, I can see where it'd be very comforting for them to have the sacrament of the altar.
Right.
You know, or to pray the Lord's Prayer. You know, I mean, you know, you don't have to pray the Lord's Prayer. It's a gift that he gives that he promises to hear. But, you know, I can just make up, I don't know. It's just, Jesus instituted this. He didn't institute very many things. Mm-hmm. You know, baptism, Holy Communion, prayer, marriage, confession, absolution, the word. What else? I don't know. We might come up with one or two more, but that's about it, right?
Right.
So anyway, as much as they wanted, it's a great phrase.
Is there a sense of, so you mentioned the fact that Jesus is lifting up his eyes, but their eyes are probably focusing on one foot in front of them. And is there a sense in which there should be a discussion about our initial response to things isn't always the right one, right? So sometimes we're so long focused that we miss the stuff right in front of us, but sometimes we're so right in front of us focused that we miss the bigger picture. And like, they're not even paying attention that they're in a grassy place in the middle of the desert or some of these other things. Like, you just miss out on things because you're so focused on the immediate thing. Is there an application there?
Oh yeah. I think that's a very, very well said. It reminded me of, you know, the reason that we teach children to draw is so that they can learn to see the world. When it's like you learn music so that you can learn to hear, because if you can't hear, right, you can't sing until you can hear. You can't play an instrument until you can hear. And learning to do those things changes the way you experience the world, and you experience actually in a more accurate way. And draw, like, you can't draw. You tell a kid to draw a tree, and he'll draw. He's got something in his mind that's a tree, but he's never really looked close enough to recognize what it looks like.
Yeah.
And so it's by it's a huge benefit, you know, to art in general. Not just that it produces things of beauty, but that we learn to see the world more accurately, actually. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, I think that that idea kind of has a theological sort of thing too, right? That we're so focused on one thing, we don't see the other. And even what we think we're seeing is misrepresented because it lacks the other. So mm-hmm. we only see, again, right, the difficulty, and we don't even recognize, I mean, we exaggerate. We just had this morning the reading from 1 Kings of Elijah under the broom tree. Mm-hmm. He's just such a big baby. You know, it's just so funny to me. You know, it's just ridiculous the way he responds. And it's just, he's just like a child throwing a tantrum, right? Mm-hmm. You know, he just called fire down from heaven and killed all these prophets. And then Jezebel issues this threat and he runs away. Mm-hmm. And then he says to God, "It's enough. I'm not better than my fathers. Let me die." grow up, you know. This is like a toddler that, you know, just completely losing his stuff and just wailing inconsolably because the sprinkles on the donut aren't straight. You know, I mean, it's such a ridiculous thing. And I love the response, right? There's no response from God except that Elijah goes to sleep, which is an incredible mercy and gift to be able to sleep. Mm-hmm. And it's also the thing that a child in a tantrum needs.
Yeah.
He wakes him up and gives him food, goes to sleep again. But anyway, there's just this, like, I really believe that kind of weakness of Elijah is put on display for all of us. It's a kind of mocking of Elijah. I think he looks like a fool. He is a fool in it. And not that we disparage him as, you know, he's not greater than his fathers, which, by the way, he thinks he is. That's why he says that. Mm-hmm. But it's disparaging what sin does to us and how we get so focused on these things that we're incapable of seeing how God is blessing us. Mm-hmm. And the goodness all around us, you know, the fact that this broom tree is giving him shade, you know, the fact that this angel provides bread and water when he needs it and sleep, the fact that, you know, fire destroyed the prophets of Baal. Yeah. I mean, right?
So maybe you could take that in connection with verse 6 where he says, "For he himself knew what he would do."
Right.
And so what are the things that we get, instead of having a long view in a bad way, that we have a short view or a view that is constrained and not seeing the big picture in a good way?
Well, I think it's mostly our inability to deny or, you know, to delay gratification. Mm-hmm. And, you know, particularly with, you know, we think this forbidden pleasure just has to be given to us in the moment because we need it. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, or this particular duty or burden, this pain has to be avoided at any cost. Mm-hmm. I mean, those are always, I think, kind of very short, right?
Yeah. So when that happens and we're focused on our immediate need or our immediate desire, is the way out not just saying that out loud, but just saying, for God knew what he would do.
Yeah. And, you know, this isn't going to matter from the perspective of eternity. I mean, I think this is one of the real problems with contemporary worship. Mm-hmm. We should be engaged in eternal worship.
Yeah.
And, you know, this contemporary, God, like you said last week, I thought that was a great line and I used it since then, that, you know, we're always pointing to our lack and God's always pointing to our abundance. You know, we're always pointing to the kind of contemporary difficulty, and, you know, from the point of eternity, I mean, it's just absolute trivia. Mm-hmm. You know, so you know, I'm mad because I don't know, you know, I was insulted by one of my members, you know, and it, you know, it just feels so huge in the moment, but that's pure pride.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at this thing even from a week later, you wouldn't care about it. Or mm-hmm. getting cut off in traffic or something. We just lose our stuff, right? We're just in this rage as though this is, you don't even remember the event by the time you get to your destination.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so, that's what the imprecatory psalms and laments teach us, isn't it? To not just stay wallowing in those things or stoking the fires of our anger, but to hand it over kind of as a release valve and then end up praising him.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's always, I think, a kind of eternal perspective. And just like he knew what he's going to do. He knows what the future is. He knows what the past is. There's no emergencies. There's no danger in that sense. Yeah. Right. Jesus isn't telling jokes on the cross.
No.
I mean, he is suffering, and there is real suffering, and Christians engage in real suffering, and we should seek to relieve that suffering and to, you know, in acts of mercy and so forth. At the same time, you know, it always should be put into this perspective, because mm-hmm. even on the cross, right, Psalm 22 includes praise.
Yeah, but in some cases, yes, relieve that suffering, but in some cases, just being there to encourage in the midst of it, the way the Father sends the angels to encourage.
Oh, yeah, good.
Right,
good.
So that, I mean, our goal shouldn't be just to take it all away, because God has a purpose for it.
Right.
And so...
Well, in some...
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I mean, we do need to make it... There is suffering that we can clearly see the purpose of.
Yes.
And then there's suffering that we can't, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, and I think sometimes we need to... One of the things that is important, and the Bible does do, is it does give purpose to our suffering. Mm-hmm. That we are in fact being purified, and we are learning to live by faith. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, that's obvious. You know, if it's sort of the pain of, you know, if you're talking to a SEM student who's trying to learn Greek, you know, and it's hard, and he wants to quit because it's just boring, right? You know, it's like, look, you know, you're suffering through this. Will be rewarded, and you know, you'll have fruit of it. And so you don't really feel that sorry for him, because it's easy to see the benefit of it. Or a child, you know, doing math homework or whatever.
Sure.
It's a little bit, you know, it's not quite as, it's not, you know, but when it's your mother-in-law that's got Alzheimer's, you know, that's a little tougher to see the purpose of, right? Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things we need to do is, like you said, encourage them. We can pray for relief. And we can ask for this, and insofar as we're able to give comfort, I mean, physical comfort, and likewise, we absolutely should. At the same time, I think we do need to voice this, you know, again, this Romans 8 thing. You know, God is using this for good.
Yeah.
And this comes from his love. And this isn't a sign, you know, Job makes the mistake of thinking this is God's doing this to me to punish me. Mm-hmm. Nope, God's doing this to you to make you stronger.
Right.
And he does that in love because he respects you.
Yeah. So,
I mean, I love that God doesn't give up on us.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I would.
Could we hear, like, look at 2 Corinthians where he starts talking about, you know, inheriting an eternal weight of glory, that that these things, these difficulties that we endure in our flesh, in this earthly tent, though it's passing away, is kind of giving us that frame to stand up under that eternal weight of glory. So not that we've earned it, but in the sense that we could actually receive it, that we have the perhaps you'd say worthy, maybe not worthy, but that you that you're able to have it.
Yeah. Well, he counts you worthy.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's the thing, right? So in that sense, I think you could say, if God gave me this, he thinks that I'm worthy. He believes and knows.
But it's not a legal fiction.
Right, right. No, he's actually saying, you can do this and I'll be there right by your side, mm-hmm. right? And we're going to do this together and it's going to be good for you and for the world or for the church. Mm-hmm.
Any doctrines that you'd want? I mean, you mentioned the Lord's Supper here. Anything?
Yeah, life is not food. Uh-huh. I mean, it's funny because I think the lesson of him giving them food is that life is not food, right? He gives them bread to show them that man does not live by bread alone. So it's both an act of mercy and compassion that he provides for their physical needs, showing that he's aware of them. But it's also a demonstration that, you know, it's nothing. He could provide bread anytime. And why doesn't he then? Why do they try to force him and make him bread king? What they want is they want bread without labor.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, they came for, hey, I'd like to, fix my bunions. And then it's like, oh, hey, you're the golden goose, you know, and we'll never have to work again. And so they turn it to this selfish purpose, but And that's why he doesn't. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's part of why he doesn't do it, because food without labor is actually not good for us.
Yeah. So in verse 10, it says that Jesus, in my translation, have the people sit down. It's actually an imperative of poieo, make the people sit down.
Yes.
Is there any theological significance here? Like, are they wanting to keep going? Or is he forcing them to rest?
Oh, that's interesting. I mean, I think it's more of just, it's time for dinner.
Okay.
So I don't think there's any place for them to go, but there is this sort of, requirement for them to sit down and shut up, mm-hmm. and to receive what they're given, and mm-hmm. to, right, when they're standing, you know, they're sort of fidgeting, I imagine.
So, and could we say something to the effect of, they're still focused on the immediate and the things that they want to ask him, and he's saying, yeah. Sit down, remember the Sabbath day by keeping it holy. Like, so
yeah.
you get the command and you think like, oh, he's telling me what to do, but actually he's giving me a whole day, yeah. for rest and refreshment. And we view it as, stop telling me what to do.
Right, right, right. You're not the boss of me, right? Well, it's like, take, eat, you know, that's a command also.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting. They come explicitly for healings of diseases, and he doesn't, as far as we know, there's no healings.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, they're probably standing in line, you know, in some sense, they're trying to get to the front so that he can heal, mm-hmm. whatever ailment they have. And then he's like, sit down, it's dinner time.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to be an irresistible command. Yeah. They all sit down and they all get fed, and the bulk of them do not understand what has happened. And of course, the disciples don't either, as we'll see later.
Right.
But okay. Yeah, it's a remarkable thing. It's funny that it is interesting too, that it's a grassy place. You know, mm-hmm. he has found this pasture that has a certain, I mean, the thing is it's not fruitful for, it's the only way it's fruitful for men is if, you know, livestock graze there, because people can't eat grass, mm-hmm. right? So there's a kind of softness to it, but there's no food.
Yeah.
And
there's no food without this, even in those places, without the sweat of your brow. This is a food,
yeah.
that didn't cost them anything.
Right.
What does it cost our Lord?
That's good, yeah. I know. That's an interesting question to me. Do the miracles cost? I mean, we'd have to say in some sense no, right? There's nothing can be taken from the Holy Trinity. I mean, he is complete and full of himself. He can't be reduced in that sense. But it does seem as though, maybe according to his humiliation, that there is a toll on Jesus, right? He withdraws from various times. He grows weary,
mm-hmm.
grows angry even, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I wonder if the miracles don't cost him in his humiliation, according to his human nature, yeah. at some level.
Well, you know, as you would say, this is also what kind of ramps things up.
Mm.
I mean, you know, from now on, they're going to be coming after him. So.
It does ramp stuff up. It's true.
Yeah.
Well, it's sort of further along in John than it seems too, because, you know, John doesn't have as many chapters.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they're long chapters, but so, I mean, 6 is further along than it might sound.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, because he's,
that makes sense.
Once he gets in chapter 7, he's in Jerusalem the rest of the time, isn't he?
Right. So it's like, you know, we're right. So this is towards the end in that sense. So.
Yeah. Okay. What are you going to preach on?
Well, I think I might try to do something with this his lifting up of his eyes and kind of getting at this footprints theology without using that.
Yeah.
I mean, I think there is something to be said there that is true.
Mm-hmm.
And is helpful, and that I think is demonstrated in this. And then, of course, I want to make the Eucharistic application, right? He sees you trudging through life, right? Mm-hmm. And you don't, you know, you're maybe lost in your own misery and unaware, but he's leading you to the supper. He's led you to this place this morning, mm-hmm. and here's the food of refreshment.
Yeah, and so sit down.
Oh, I was going to, yeah, sit down. I was going to read you this thing from Parsh. He's got this whole thing about, apparently in the Roman liturgy, there's a lot of references to Moses this week, not just on Sunday, but on the weekdays. Mm. And so he's really fascinated by Jesus being the new Moses, right? Instituting the new Passover, feeding with manna, mm-hmm. all that stuff. And so he has this this nice thing comparing, well, I'll read it to you. So he says, Moses' significance in the liturgy of Lent can be seen from the fact that he is the object of 15 responsories this week. He was called by God to be the savior, leader, provider, and teacher of the chosen people. After many rebuffs from Pharaoh, he led his people out of bondage on the night of the Passover. Under his direction, they slaughtered and ate the Paschal lamb. With them, he passed dry shod through the Red Sea. In the desert, he provided manna, obtained the law and the commandments upon Sinai, spoke most intimately with God, mediated and interceded for his people. Their shortcomings he bore with incomparable patience. On all these points, Moses prefigured Christ. Then he says, sent by the Father into the world, Christ wrestled with hell's Pharaoh, led his people out of Egypt on Passover night, and offered himself as the Paschal lamb to be immolated and consumed by all. He guides his people through the Red Sea of baptism after he himself blazed the way through the Red Sea of suffering. Mm. And now he accompanies us through life's desert, feeds us with manna, and gives us the fountain of the Eucharist from which to drink. And with ineffable patience, he leads us to the promised land of heaven. Christians, Easter is near. The divine Moses is leading us out of Egypt.
Wow.
That's pretty good. It's pretty good, isn't it?
It's very good.
He also has here that Moses was prepared to receive the law by fasting. He says earlier, fasting therefore made possible the creation of the old law upon the mountain, but gluttony on the plain below seduced the people to the worship of idols.
Oh, that's really
good. There's a lot of good stuff in him. Yeah.
So you're going to do lifting up your eyes and footprints in the sand. Yeah. I can't wait to hear that.
What are you going to do?
I don't know. I kind of want to make something out of this, and he knew what he would do. And just kind of bring out, and maybe just going through the Old Testament, like he knew what he would do. Like give those examples. And then, so also here, why would it be any different in your life?
Yeah.
Something, I don't know.
Yeah, that's good. All right.
All right.
Well, thanks.
Yep. We'll pick up with Lent 5 next week. Thanks.
All right.